From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. As the ceasefire in Syria runs out today, there are reports of skirmishes between Kurds and Turkish forces. But the Trump administration may be partially reversing course on a complete withdrawal of troops from Syria. Defense Secretary Mark Esper said yesterday that some troops may stay to protect oil fields against the Islamic State, which may be rising again. Esper said President Trump has not seen details of the plan yet. Trump ordered the original withdrawal despite objections from world leaders and bipartisan lawmakers. NPR Pentagon reporter Tom Bowman joins us now. And Tom, U.S. troops left Syria in a hurry, but now some might stay. How many will remain and where?
Well, Tanya, it looks like maybe a couple of hundred will stay, and as you say, to protect those oil fields. Esper talked about it, and actually President Trump echoed that at a cabinet meeting. He said, if troops stay, it will be to protect the oil. Now, the oil fields, as Esper said, they want to keep them out of the hands of ISIS and other groups. And it's interesting to note that it wasn't ISIS that tried to grab the oil fields last year when I was over there. It was Russian mercenaries. And they were pushed back by withering U.S. airstrikes. Of the 500 that tried to grab the oil field, about half of them were killed in those airstrikes. So it's not just ISIS. And frankly, the Russians probably have more firepower and more fighters that could actually roll in there and grab the oil fields. But it's a big concern. They want to protect the oil fields and also kind of use them as leverage against the Syrian government and against Russia to come to some sort of an agreement in the country.
Okay. What have Pentagon officials told you about these plans? Are they coming straight from the Department of Defense, or has the White House had anything to do with them?
Well, it's always a mixture of both. The White House, of course, has a say. And we know President Trump has said he wants to remove troops from places like Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan. The Pentagon says more needs to be done. ISIS has not been defeated in this case, and we still have to stay the course. Now, it's interesting. This is the third time that President Trump has tried to pull all the troops out of Syria. When I was there in February of 2018, he announced all would be leaving. The Pentagon talked him out of it. And again, in December of 2018, he said all 2,000 troops would come out. There was a compromise, and they kept 1,000. Here we are, October of 2019, and he says all 1,000 out. And now people are dragging their feet on that and saying it looks like, you know, maybe a couple of hundred will stay.
Yeah. In Iraq, how do Iraqis feel about more military, U.S. military in their country?
Well, Iraqi officials were not all that happy about it when Defense Secretary Esper announced it. He said these troops would be going to western Iraq to continue the fight against ISIS from there. And the Iraqi official said, wait a minute, you haven't received permission to come in with those extra troops. So he is talking to Iraqi officials, trying to smooth things over. And as he has said, they want to continue the ISIS fight from Iraq, but that's going to be very difficult. You need troops on the ground to mount an effective fight. What they can do from Iraq, if they're allowed to, is surveillance flights, maybe some airstrikes, across border raids, perhaps. But you really need folks on the ground to go after ISIS.
And we know that President Erdogan met today with Putin, and we're learning about the outcome of that meeting. With this ceasefire coming to an end very quickly, what happens next?
Well, likely much more fighting between Kurdish fighters and these Turkish-backed militias. President Erdogan of Turkey said there are still 1,300 fighters left in that safe zone they're trying to create. So we'll see what happens. But U.S. military officials I talk with say expect a lot more fighting.
NPR Pentagon reporter Tom Bowman, thank you.
Well, the Iowa caucuses will start the voting in the 2020 presidential race a little more than 3 months from now. Iowa is home to 31 counties that flipped from Barack Obama to Donald Trump in 2016, more than any other state. And those counties helped Trump win Iowa, and maintaining them will be key to his reelection bid. Here and Now's Chris Bentley has this look at how that support is holding up.
Dan Snicker heads the Republican Party in Clinton County, Iowa. He says 3 years ago, lots of new faces came through the door of this office in downtown Clinton in the months before the 2016 election.
They wanted two things. They wanted a Trump yard sign. They wanted to know how to change their party affiliation. And you quiz them, they said, well, we want to raise family. We want to be able to buy our house, and that American dream is disappearing.
This part of eastern Iowa is home to industrial Mississippi River cities like Dubuque, lots of rural farmland, and small towns like Clinton. 9 out of 10 Iowa counties along the state's eastern border flipped from blue to red in 2016. Smicker is confident Trump will carry Clinton County again in 2020.
Yeah, I think he will. As far as the party goes, nobody is apologizing for supporting the president. Does he do everything that everyone would do? Nobody does. But the leadership he's provided and the remembering his campaign promises is amazing.
But not everyone in eastern Iowa who voted for Trump is happy with what he's done in office. Faye Rowling is a farmer and a nursing assistant in rural Jackson County, Iowa, which also flipped for Trump in 2016. She says she voted for Trump because of his promises to help farmers like her. Now she regrets that vote.
I don't see what he's done at all, but did damage to the farmers with China and...
You don't think he's really standing up for people in Iowa?
No, I don't like him. He just is a poor president.
Rowling recently changed her party affiliation so she can caucus with the Democrats next year. She hasn't made up her mind yet about which candidate to support. The key question for Republicans is whether Rowling is an anomaly or a sign that the president's support might be fading in parts of the Midwest, key to helping him stay in the White House. Andy McKean thinks it's a trend. He served 7 terms as a Republican, representing mostly rural constituents in the Iowa State House of Representatives. This year, midway through his 8th term, he switched his party affiliation to Democratic.
The Republican Party, I feel, has become somewhat extreme in some of their priorities, and not to say that the Democratic Party doesn't have its problems, too, but I felt more comfortable as a moderate Democrat and made the switch.
McKean says Trump's spending is reckless, his foreign policy erratic, and the economy Trump touts on the campaign trail?
I think it's a house of cards ready to fall, and I think, sure, the stock market is up for the moment, but you just wait and see what happens to it eventually. But I do believe that a more middle-of-the-road Democrat would be a very, very strong competitor for Trump, and I think would get a lot of not only Democrats, but a lot of independents and a lot of disillusioned Republicans.
But many Republicans in eastern Iowa disagree. Michael Cassaday, a retired doctor in Clinton County, voted for Trump in 2016 and is eager to vote for him again.
I genuinely think that he is out to make things better for our country. With the treaties he's trying to get reorganized, with the reduction of regulations, I think he sent a message to lots of different countries that we're going to take care of ourselves first, and then if you don't like it, if you're messing with us, we're going to take care of you.
Pauline Chilton, a 41-year-old real estate broker in Dubuque, changed her party affiliation from Democratic to Republican to vote for Trump in 2016. Chilton identifies as half Black, half Asian, and she says President Trump's support is more diverse than many people think.
It may look like he has support from mostly white people, but not everybody's loud about who they're supporting, especially when there is some backlash. Most Republicans support Trump. The ones who don't support him, I think, is a very small percentage. And I believe that there has been a growing number of people in Dubuque County who support him because they're happy with the job that he's doing.
As for the impeachment inquiry House Democrats are pursuing, Chilton calls it a political stunt. And 94% of Republicans agree with Chilton that Trump should not be impeached and removed from office, according to a poll out this week from the Public Religion Research Institute. But another poll published last week by Quinnipiac University shows a majority of voters nationwide support the House's impeachment inquiry. That could be a problem for Republicans in states like Iowa, where the party needs to win over independents and not just turn out the president's base. Alexis Lundgren is chair of the Dubuque County Republican Party. She says in eastern Iowa, the impeachment inquiry will likely boost Republican turnout for Trump.
I think right now what's going on is pushing the Republicans closer to Trump. When I have conversations with people, they're irritated just like I am. They want this to be over with and done, and we want to work on something else that's going to better, you know, everyone. I don't think it's doing anything bad for us. I think it's doing bad for the Democrats.
Turnout in Iowa was down in 2016 compared to 2008 and 2012 for both parties, but especially for Democrats. President Trump also won a larger share of independents than Hillary Clinton, and those no-party voters were key to his victory. Tom Barton is a 53-year-old independent from Dubuque. He says he's undecided right now. He voted in 2016, but won't say for whom, because he says he doesn't want to alienate friends and clients of his business. Barton owns a wealth management firm and says his number one issue is the economy.
As a financial guy, it's frustrating as hell when you're only one tweet away from your whole apple cart being upset here. And so that's worn on me the last 3 years. You know, I don't know. I guess I'm for the party that's going to help people do the best economically. And right now, I don't know who that is.
Winning over no-party voters like Barton is just as important to President Trump's chances at re-election as energizing his base. Republicans will find out next year if Trump can shore up that coalition against a flagging approval rating and an impeachment inquiry with growing support. For Here and Now, I'm Chris Bentley.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
According to the American Heart Association, nearly half of all adults in the U.S. have some kind of cardiovascular disease. And heart disease is responsible for close to 1 in 4 American deaths this year. It is the leading cause of deaths in the U.S. and around the world. But that rate has been in steady decline for decades because of developments in drugs, medical procedures, and everyday lifestyle recommendations. For more, we're joined by Sandeep Jahar. He is the director of the Heart Failure Program at Long Island Jewish Medical Center and the author of the book, Heart, A History. Dr. Jahar, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
So heart disease is still the leading cause of death in the U.S., but not as much as it was a few decades ago. Why is that?
Well, yes, you rightly point out that a few decades ago, heart disease was actually much more prevalent. Actually, in the 1940s and 50s, before the government got involved in heart research, nearly 1 out of 2 Americans were dying of cardiovascular disease. So things have improved, and for a lot of reasons. I mean, there are drugs that have come about, like cholesterol-lowering drugs. There are procedures like angioplasty, bypass surgery, a lot of technology. And then there have been societal changes, like decreases in smoking and encouraging exercise and sort of knowledge of risk factors. So there are a number of things, but, in recent decade or so, the rate of decline of cardiovascular mortality has slowed significantly.
Well, do you think, and as you listed all of those off, I noticed that the first thing that you said was drugs. Do you think that it's more about the treatment that has brought the deaths from heart disease down, or is it more about lifestyle changes like exercise and reduction in smoking?
I think it's multifactorial. You know, one of the first results out of the landmark Framingham trial was that smoking increased risk for heart disease. And so there was a concerted effort, at a national level to cut down on smoking. And that's largely been successful, although in recent years, the rate of decline of smoking has significantly slowed. So I think lifestyle factors have played a role. I think there's still a lot more to be done on the lifestyle front. And that's one of the things I talk about, in my book, is how stress management increasingly, will need to be front and center in how we think about heart problems.
And how should people work to deal with that, with this stress side of it?
Well, it's interesting. The heart was always thought to contain the emotions, but it was always thought to be sort of a metaphorical link. But now we know that the actual biological heart, the pump, is strongly sensitive to emotional outbreak, disruption, stress. So, there are a number of things that we can do. The first thing is to recognize that it's a problem. We have now more data in the last, few decades to show that stress is incredibly detrimental to heart function. We know, for example, that the heart can acutely weaken in response to acute grief, like after a romantic breakup, the so-called broken heart syndrome. Mm-hmm. So how we cope with it is probably individual. It has to do with, our own individual proclivities of what works for us. But on a society, you know, wide level, I think we need to have more, you know, understanding of the role that stress plays in our lives.
Let's talk about treatments. What are the main treatments at this point for heart disease in this country, and how are they changing?
Well, there are sort of two main categories. I mean, one is, you know, lifestyle factors. So, you know, encouraging patients not to smoke, to, you know, eat right. The other category is medications. So we have, over the last 50 or so years, developed incredibly powerful medications like statins, for example, which lower cholesterol, and beta blockers, ACE inhibitors, and so on. So drugs, you know, undoubtedly play a strong role in treating heart disease. And then there are procedures. Many people don't realize that, you know, in the last maybe 60 or 70 years, we've developed most of the procedures that we really take for granted in helping us treat heart disease. Coronary angioplasty, like stents, for example, coronary bypass surgery, pacemakers, defibrillators, heart transplants. All those things were developed mostly in America after World War II. So there's been a huge technological, you know, progress.
Well, and if somebody has to get, and so many Americans do at this point, have to get valve procedures done or angioplasty, stents put in, bigger procedures, are they risky? Are they, like, should people be as scared as they often are to have to get something like that done at this point? Or have doctors gotten so good at them that they're not as risky as they were?
Yeah, I mean, what's riskier is having the disease. The treatments often are much less risky for a patient. So, you know, for example, when heart attacks were relatively untreated in the 1950s, the mortality from an acute heart attack in the hospital was about 30%. Now it's about 3% with angioplasty and so on. That's a tenfold decrease. So there's been, you know, huge improvements. Any procedure, any surgery poses some risks, but I think those risks are decreasing, especially now as we develop relatively non-invasive ways of, you know, fixing our hearts. So, for example, you mentioned valves. It used to be that we'd have to cut open the chest, cut open the heart, cut out the diseased valve, put in a new valve, sew it in, and then sew up the heart, and then close the chest. That was a huge procedure that took several hours and usually involved weeks of rehabilitation. Today, we can put in a valve, a new valve in a patient through a sort of stent procedure, a catheter that goes in through the groin and is pushed up to the heart, and the valve can be inserted that way. No surgery involved, not cutting open the chest, and the procedure has actually been shown to be superior to conventional surgery, and the patients have rehab times that are a couple of days rather than several weeks. So we're making amazing progress, but still a lot more needs to be done.
I want to ask you about one more treatment, if you will, but it probably doesn't belong in the same category as stents and drugs and a healthy lifestyle. But there's been a couple of recent studies that have linked dog ownership to better chances of surviving if you have heart disease or have had a heart attack. What do you think about that?
I love dogs. I
so do I.
We just got a, you know, we got a dog a year ago, and it's transformed all of our lives. It seems that dog ownership provides several health benefits. I mean, you know, one thing is that, you know, you have to walk your dog, and so the exercise from that. But I think, you know, on a deeper level, dogs provide companionship and combat loneliness, and we know that these things are tremendously detrimental to health. So I think that the love that we get from pets alleviates stress, and we know stress is bad. So I would say, you know, when you asked me earlier, well, what do we do about the stress? Well, we don't have a pill like we do for cholesterol. So reducing emotional stress is much more difficult. And that may be the reason why the American Heart Association doesn't recognize emotional stress as a risk factor for heart disease, because we don't know what to do with it. But I would say that figure out what's right for you: yoga, physical exercise, meditation, and yes, you know, pet ownership. people I know who own pets, especially dogs, tend to be happier.
You've had heart issues yourself.
Yes.
And what have you done to get your lifestyle in a way that you feel you're reducing risk of any issues in the future?
Well, I got a dog. I wrote my book in part because I had a very malignant family history of heart disease, and I wanted to explore the heart, you know, a little more deeply, both as a metaphorical organ and as a biological organ. But when I learned that I have heart disease, I sort of looked at my life and I looked at what I wasn't doing right. And I was doing a lot of things right already. I was, you know, eating pretty well. I was exercising. I was already taking a cholesterol-lowering medication. But for me, it was really on the emotional front. I mean, I was like running on a treadmill, constantly forcing. I was very ambitious about my work. And I realized I had to slow down a little bit. What's been most effective is focusing on this sort of stress management front, spending more time with my children, trying not to get so stressed out about things that happen at work, for example, having a puppy, these mm-hmm. things just make me happy. And so people need to figure out what's right for them. What's right for me or for someone else may not be right for you. So,
do you think that there's something about the American system that leads so many people to have heart issues, that we're just such a work-oriented culture, that everybody's working, some people, two jobs to make ends meet?
I think there's truth to that. I spent some time in Europe recently, on my book tour, and it's amazing, in the evenings, people gather, in the town square and have, beer together with people they know from the town. I mean, there isn't that kind of conviviality in, at least in the places I've lived in the U.S. And then there are other things. Obviously, we have a pretty sedentary lifestyle. We tend to be more overweight than we should be. And yes, we're very driven as a society to consume and achieve more and more. So I think all these things, play a role.
That is Dr. Sandeep Jahar, who is the director of the Heart Failure Program at Long Island Jewish Medical Center and author of the book Heart, A History. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
From coast to coast to coast, tonight, Canadians rejected division and negativity. They rejected cuts and austerity, and they voted in favor of a progressive agenda and strong action on climate change.
That's Justin Trudeau, and he's headed into a second term as Prime Minister of Canada, despite a tight race and a series of scandals that rocked the Canadian government. For more on this, we're joined by CBC reporter Salima Shivji. She's been on the campaign trail and joins us from Montreal. Hi, Salima.
Hi.
So this race was not the nail-biting, too-close-to-call race many of us were expecting. But I can imagine there's definitely a different feeling in the air from when Trudeau won back in 2015. What's been the reaction there?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, Trudeau didn't so much win as he managed not to lose this time around. You mentioned those controversies. He had that, obviously, the photos of him wearing blackface that were came out in the media. He had to apologize. But look, they're happy with this result, considering the rise for the Bloc Québécois in Quebec. Bloc Québécois is a sovereignist party, but has put the focus more on nationalism this time around. So putting sovereignty on the back burner, that really cut into Justin Trudeau's vote base in Quebec. So they are satisfied with the result, but definitely in that room last night at Liberal headquarters, there was applause, there were cheers, but it was much more muted.
So we heard in a clip earlier Trudeau say in his victory speech that Canadians rejected division and negativity and voted for a progressive agenda. Can you talk a little bit more about the issues that really swayed voters to vote for him?
Well, he kept talking about that, the need for a progressive government. He really turned up that rhetoric in the last 10 days. That's sort of like a veiled call to strategic voting in our system, basically, because on the left, he was losing support to the Bloc Québécois in Quebec and losing support to the New Democrats in the rest of Canada and English Canada. And what's important about this victory for Justin Trudeau is the Liberals were completely wiped off the map in the prairies. So Alberta, Saskatchewan, and those are provinces where the downturn in oil prices has really hurt the industry. Those are provinces that are historically very conservative. So in terms of him talking about, you know, Canadians have chosen not against division, we need to work together. That whole working together bit is going to be very difficult in his mandate because of the lack of representation in those provinces. So he's left with a divided country because of the nature of the campaign as well. Justin Trudeau had to wear a bulletproof vest at one point at one rally, which is a first here for us. So it will be a difficult mandate for him, and it will be difficult to sort of heal the divisions and the divide.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about that divide. So this victory ensures that Trudeau's Liberal Party will return to power, but as a minority government. Explain a little bit about what that means.
Yeah, so in our system, you need about 170 seats to win a majority, and that means that you can pass bills easily with the majority in Parliament. In this case, Justin Trudeau is shy of that number, and so he's going to have to work with most likely the New Democrats, which are more philosophically aligned with the Liberals. So to get some of his bills passed and his agenda passed is going to take a lot of negotiation, and that's just another thing that Justin Trudeau is going to have to work harder at to get his agenda passed in the House.
That's CBC reporter Salima Shivji. Salima, thank you so much for joining us from Montreal.
You're welcome.
Well, let's take a break from the news now for another edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Jason Kramer is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. He joins us once again. Hi, Jason.
Jeremy, how are you?
Doing well. And before we get started here, is there any theme to the music that you have brought us today? Can you put them all into a category?
Everything that I'm bringing today kind of has this "we will prevail" attitude. We've lived so long with singer-songwriters with their cathartic moments and they're sad and this and have you. But I noticed as I was kind of, you know, reviewing the tracks and listening to every track, every song has to do about getting out of the grime or getting out of bad situations and becoming great.
All right. Well, with "We Will Prevail" in mind, let's get to some of the music. This is called "Dance Monkey" by The Tones and I.
You know you stopped me dead while I was passing by.
Very catchy, and that voice is pretty unique.
Oh, she's just fabulous. I first heard her, I think, just like everybody else on the internet. But this is Toni Watson. She's 19 years old from Australia. And she had put out a song a while prior that did very well virally. And then she decided, you know what, I'm going to kind of keep going with this. And she wrote the song about being a busker. You know, as a kid, she would busk in the streets of Melbourne and also did it in a city called Byron.
And this song, Dance Monkey, has shot up to number one on the Australian charts.
Australia, Denmark, Finland, Ireland, New Zealand, Norway, Sweden, Switzerland. And she now is signed to a label out here in the United States under Elektra. And they are going to be doing wonders with her. I think we're going to hear a lot more from her. And I'm really excited because she's got one of these infectious voices that I keep getting drawn to.
Okay, the next one is Living Proof. This is by Des Rock.
I'm living proof that the roof can be beat. If you pull yourself together, you can get on your feet. Living proof
tell us about this one.
So Des Rock, born in New York, and really has that classic rock sound with more of an updated vibe. He's a guy that just, you know, grew up listening to bands like Elvis, Roy Orbison, Queen, also Hendrix. Mm-hmm. And he created this song because it was a song that was about a band that he was in, and it wasn't doing too well, and they ended up breaking up. And it's not about the breaking up of the band, but it's really, you know, getting through the darkest times of your life and coming back and kind of revamping yourself. And this is what we hear today. This guy is just amazing. He records everything in New York because he wants that vibe that New York City has, that uncertain vibe of the city itself.
Interesting. You think it makes that big of a difference to be recording in a different city to get that different vibe?
Well, the Beach Boys recorded here in Los Angeles.
Where else could they possibly record?
Exactly.
Really, okay, the next one that you have brought us is called Ode to Justin Bieber. This is by Hobo Johnson.
Yeah, it's really, really weird. I want the whole world to love you. I think it's pretty bad for my life and relationships. Sometimes I walk into public and instantly think that the public doesn't like me. I don't really know what I want, but I do know that I want a little more of your attention, your love. Just look me in the eyes. So I try to make you. 2 DUIs, 7,000 for the state. If I don't blow up, then I'm going back for minimum wage. So just smile, yo, please smile. Look me in the eyes. Hold it for a while. It's really, really weird. Want the whole world to love you. Kill all the pop stars, replace them with wholesome adults. And I'm getting better at being better and being nice to my friends or whatever. It's really, really weird to have the whole world judge you. Justin Bieber never even got a fair shake. If you buy your mom a house when you're 13, you gon' be f***ed up mentally, you know? I'm really, really sorry that nobody understands. And let me teach you like that.
I'm trying really hard to follow everything that he's saying there. So tell us, what is he talking about?
It's so fun. This album, it's called The Fall of Hobo Johnson. It's a sophomoric album. His last release was called The Rise of Hobo Johnson. But this album, I can't get enough of. From the very first time I heard it till even today, I either play a song once a day. But this song is actually called An Ode to Justin Bieber. It's kind of the way that Frank Lopez Jr., who's Hobo Johnson, it's his way of grasping and grappling with the fame of money at a young age and really how can it mess you up, you know, growing up. And here, Frank was, you know, born in Sacramento, and he was homeless by the time he was 19 and was able to get, you know, a giant record contract. Well, one thing I want to say about him, what really draws me about Hobo Johnson, it's this brilliance of composition, and it kind of reminds me of Carl Stalling. And when Carl did the Warner Brother cartoons. And you can also hear kind of a Danny Elfman vibe to this.
Okay, the next one you brought us is from across the pond in the UK. This is What You Won't Do for Love by Luke Burr.
What you won't do for love. You tried everything, but you don't give up. In my world, only you makes me do for love what I would not do. My friends wonder what is wrong with me. Well, I'm in a daze from your love, you see. I came back to let you know that I got a thing for you. Can't let it go, no.
So people may remember the Bobby Caldwell version of this, but this guy is 22 years old.
Yeah, born in Essex, 22, started playing small pubs at 15, and just really, you know, they say butter's not a good thing for you when you get older, but this is a butter I enjoy. He's got a voice that's just absolutely amazing. You know, a lot of people may know him, especially if they're from over the pond, because he had a song that featured on the TV show Love Island. And that was the song that we heard, the Bobby Caldwell track. And that next morning, from what Luke tells me, he was number one on Shazam in the UK after that episode aired. So there is a power to that.
Okay, well, we have time for one more, Jason, and this is called Strange by Celeste.
I tried for you, trying to see through all smoke, and it wouldn't move.
beautiful voice.
Oh, it's so haunting, isn't it?
Yeah.
This song was partly inspired while she was here in Los Angeles in November of last year when we had all of our wildfires. Hmm. And what's so beautiful about this and also scary at the same time is it's had such a profound effect that here people could have just these wonderful lives with their families and houses and living in nice neighborhoods or just living in neighborhoods. And the next second, everything has gone to ashes.
And by the way, she's 24 years old. So keep it with the theme. That is Jason Kramer, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. As always, you can go to our Spotify playlist. It's NPR Here and Now. Also, we're on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org. Jason, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Forty-seven states have now joined a New York State probe, which looks into allegations that Facebook put consumer data at risk and pushed up advertising rates. This comes as CEO Mark Zuckerberg defends his decision to allow political ads on the site after new questions about the company's role in spreading misinformation ahead of the 2020 elections. On Monday, the company announced it had banned Russian and Iranian groups from both Facebook and Instagram for violating its rules against, quote, coordinated inauthentic behavior. Zuckerberg told NBC News that the posts were part of a highly sophisticated campaign by Russia and Iran.
They signal that these nation states intend to be active in the upcoming elections. But it's also, I think, a sign that we've been able to proactively identify them and take them down.
For more, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Peter Kafka is senior correspondent at Recode. Hey, Peter.
Hi there.
So first, tell us about these Russian and Iranian groups that Facebook said it kicked off the platform yesterday. What were they posting?
Facebook didn't go that much into the content of what they're posting. They're saying the behavior is the problem. But what it seems like is these are three Iranian groups, one Russian group posting in North America and other countries. It's kind of a replay of what we saw in 2016 retroactively, where they're in some cases promoting a specific point of view, but generally trying to sort of sow dissension among American voters, voters in other countries, voters in Latin America. But basically, this is sort of a replay of what we saw in 2016, primarily from Russian hackers at the time. And now we see Iranians and other groups using the same playbook.
Was Facebook able to determine whether those posts had any impact and who they were targeting?
Facebook doesn't go into what impact those posts have had, except to say that they didn't have a lot of reach. What they're saying is these things didn't travel very far. They had a limited number of followers. They were seen by a limited number of people. We basically, what they're saying is we were able to catch this relatively early.
And those accounts you are talking about back in 2016 were linked to the Internet Research Agency. They were a so-called troll farm based in Russia, according to former special counsel Robert Mueller. Do we have any sense of whether Facebook is more prepared to deal with this kind of activity ahead of 2020?
That's what Facebook is saying. In fact, one of the points they were trying to make with their announcement yesterday, the measures we put into place after 2016 are helping us detect this kind of behavior. And by the way, it's making it harder for people who want to sort of hack Facebook to do it. They made a point of saying the Iranian groups that were up to no good didn't get that much done, and that the Russian group, which was, they say, related to the Internet Research Agency, the Russian group had to spend a lot of energy to accomplish very little. They're saying, look, the work we've done here is working for us. We're doing a better job of cleaning up the platform.
Yeah. And then there's another story that we heard about just a few weeks ago. Facebook is still facing questions about its policy that allows politicians to lie in political ads on the platform. Senator Elizabeth Warren was very vocal about this. She posted a fake ad just to show how the system works. How is Zuckerberg defending this decision?
He's spending a lot of time defending it. He gave a speech last week in Washington defending it, and they held a press conference yesterday. In theory, it was supposed to talk about election security, but Zuckerberg spent half his time answering questions about politicians lying in political ads. What Zuckerberg is saying is Facebook shouldn't be the one censoring political speech. Now, granted, they're a private company. They can make whatever decision they want, but they're saying we're not comfortable making those decisions. If politicians want to lie, we believe voters should be able to decide for themselves if they want to believe those lies.
Hmm.
Zuckerberg also pointed out that Twitter and Google have the same policy, but they don't get the same level of criticism. And he cast himself as a defender of free speech. How is that defense being received by the public and really lawmakers, who, by the way, will have a chance to question Zuckerberg tomorrow when he testifies before the House Financial Services Committee on Facebook's cryptocurrency project?
Yeah, that defense is not going over well. He's now getting criticism from both the left and the right. I think if you're within Facebook, you'd say, look, we're kind of damned either way. If we allow politicians to lie, people are going to be upset about us. And if we were to prevent them from lying in political ads, we'd get the same level of grief, if not maybe more. So we're in a tight spot either way. I think what they're hoping is maybe at the end of the 2020 election cycle, this goes away to some degree.
One other thing I want to ask you about. Bloomberg reports that Zuckerberg privately recommended several potential hires to the presidential campaign of South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg. I'm wondering, does this mean that tech is lining up behind Buttigieg?
Buttigieg does have some appeal within Silicon Valley. My colleague Teddy Schlafer has reported the fact that a lot of tech folks seem to like him. Granted, a lot of them seem to like Elizabeth Warren, who's very critical of Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. In the case of Zuckerberg, Buttigieg and Zuckerberg were sort of contemporaries at Harvard. They know friends. They have friends mm-hmm. in common.
They both went to Harvard at the same time.
Right. It wouldn't be unusual for them to have some sort of shared connections, but they both have sort of downplayed whatever connections they have.
That's Peter Kafka, senior correspondent at Recode. Thank you so much, Peter.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now. I'm Jeremy Hobson. The impeachment inquiry continues this week with more closed-door testimony on Capitol Hill. Democrats are expected to follow it up with public hearings and then possibly a vote on impeachment. We'll talk about that, the situation in Syria, and the Democratic primary with our political strategists. That's next time on Here and Now.